Something truly awful dawned on Claire as she noted some of the dates that Reiner had come in. 3 days before the slaughter of Webb's team in the courtyard had occurred was one date that popped out at Claire. She put the papers down and went over to the filing cabinet. It was locked too, yet cheaply constructed, and she quickly levered it open with the screwdriver, no longer caring about professional etiquette. She started pulling out files. There were many agents and spouses of FBI agents represented in here from many parts of the bureau. She scanned some of the files. Like Reiner's, they involved an inordinate number of hypnosis sessions. Claire's thoughts raced. Hypnosis was a funny thing. You could, in very rare circumstances, use it to get someone to do something he or she ordinarily wouldn't do. But what you also could do was put a person under, get him or her relaxed and comfortable and trusting, and then subtly pry information on what this person as agent was doing, or in the cases of a spouse of the agent, what the husband or wife was doing. Claire could envision O'Bannon coaxing out from a hypnotized and vulnerable and perhaps distressed Debbie Reiner whatever details she knew of her husband's work, including what target was going to be visited by HRT and exactly when, if Teddy Reiner shared that with his wife. And some men would, despite professional rules that prohibited it. Many marriages, Claire knew, trumped all such policies, if just to keep domestic peace. Or it could be as simple as a slip of the tongue by one of the HRT men, which a hypnotized wife would then unwittingly pass on. It would all be fairly simple for someone as experienced as Ed O'Bannon. And as she had done with Webb, O'Bannon could always give a carefully crafted post-hypnotic suggestion that would swab away from the person's memory anything suspicious that might have occurred during hypnosis, even the fact that they had been hypnotized at all. My God, Claire thought, Debbie Reiner might have unwittingly aided in her husband's murder. And on top of that, the listening devices recorded all of the confidential information that was given by the patients who came here. Valuable information that could later be used to blackmail them or set others up, as Webb's team had been. Without going into detail, Webb had mentioned that things were going wrong at the Bureau. If Claire was right about what O'Bannon was doing, the psychiatrist could be behind many of these problems. As she stared at the file cabinet, Claire's gaze settled on something that wasn't there. Under the letter L, there were several files for people with a last name that started with that letter. But there was a large and empty hanging file. Claire wondered if that was where Webb's file had been. Yet the one O'Bannon had given her wasn't nearly as large as the space she was looking at, unless he had not given her the whole file. Would the men have kept part of the file away from her? O'Bannon was a supremely confident, even arrogant man, she knew. In his mind, no one was smarter or more experienced. It was just possible he was withholding information to keep her in the dark. Perhaps he had had an even more powerful reason, beyond professional vanity, to keep Webb as a patient. She immediately started scouring the office. She worked through the man's desk and any other space where the missing information could be hidden and found nothing. Then she looked up once more. The ceiling was a drop-down. She climbed on the chair again, holding her flashlight, and popped up one of the ceiling panels. On her tiptoes, she could see above the ceiling. She shone her light around and almost immediately saw a small box that had been placed on the metal framework holding up the ceiling. She moved her chair over there and quickly pulled the box down. Inside was the rest of Webb's file, and as she sat down to examine it, she discovered it was a treasure trove. Claire kept shaking her head as each new page held a stunning revelation. O'Bannon, she knew, was organized to the point of obsession, something the two had laughed about before. And he kept meticulous notes. Those notes, though cryptic and indecipherable to a layperson, revealed to Claire that he had hypnotized Webb numerous times, even more than Debbie Reiner, when Webb had come to him after his mother's death. Each time, O'Bannon had employed a post-hypnotic suggestion, much as Claire had done, to suppress the session from Webb's consciousness. Claire jolted upright as she discovered that during one of the hypnotic sessions, Webb had revealed to O'Bannon the entire episode about his stepfather's death. The notes were almost in code, but Claire saw references to Stockton, Attic, and Daddy Dearest written in all caps, enough to convince her that O'Bannon had gotten the same story she had from Webb. Now, Webb's shouting at her during the hypnotic session, "You already know this," made complete sense. His subconscious had revealed it all once, only to O'Bannon and not to her. The use of the placebos was also discussed in the notes. Claire figured they were probably to gauge how firmly O'Bannon had insinuated his commands into Webb's subconscious. And in fact, as she read further, O'Bannon had noted that the placebo had been coupled with his hypnotic suggestion to Webb that these were the most powerful sleeping pills on the market, and Webb had duly reported that the pills were working. Webb had also told O'Bannon about the contest among HRT members with the taser guns. The truth of what had happened to Webb in that alley finally hit her. It was ingenious, she thought, because it didn't have the problematic issue of making Webb do something he didn't want to do, like kill someone in cold blood, which Claire did not believe was possible, but rather commanded Webb not to do something. She contemplated calling Webb to tell him what she had figured out and to enlist his help, but she couldn't from here, not with all the listening devices around. She would have to leave the office and call him. She continued leafing through the material. The cruelest aspect of this doctor-patient relationship was revealed on the very last page and showed that O'Bannon had built in a level of certainty that Webb would perform as instructed. O'Bannon had written in his cryptic manner that he had established an excellent rapport of trust with Webb. And O'Bannon had noted that a psychiatrist, O'Bannon wisely was not claiming to have done so himself, could build into his hypnotic suggestion that he was a father figure to a patient such as Webb and would protect him against his stepfather. And that if Webb failed to carry out the psychiatrist's commands, then the stepfather would come back and kill Webb. In effect, his only safety lay in doing exactly as he was instructed. O'Bannon had concluded that Webb would make an excellent candidate for post-hypnotic suggestion and thus posed a security risk. It was only Claire's special knowledge and her familiarity with Webb's case that allowed her to read between the lines of O'Bannon's report. Claire, with her clear understanding of Webb's psychological makeup, knew it would have been impossible for Webb to counteract that command. And yet, with all that, Webb had still managed to temporarily overcome the post-hypnotic suggestion, go into that courtyard, and fire at those guns, despite a potent mental barrage telling him not to. That had to have been Webb's most remarkable performance of the night. Claire had to concede that O'Bannon had written his report very craftily and was obviously covering his tracks, another reason for her to be careful. O'Bannon had foreseen just about every contingency, except for Claire's treating Webb, finding out for herself what O'Bannon already had from plumbing the depths of Webb's subconscious, and now her discovering both the bugs and this file. No wonder O'Bannon had tried so hard to keep Webb as his patient. It was time to call in the people who knew how to handle these things. She was way out of her league. Claire turned to go back to her office to grab her things and leave. The man was standing there watching her. She held up her screwdriver, but he pointed a gun at her. And Ed O'Bannon looked as though he would have no problem using it. Chapter 45. Back at Quantico, Webb put away his gear and gave his debriefing along with the rest of the crew. They couldn't explain much. Webb believed the shots could have come from outside the building. If so, those bullets would have to be in the room somewhere, though there were lots of slugs embedded in the walls that would have to be sorted through and matched to their respective weapons. The snipers were being debriefed as well, but Webb didn't know what they had seen or heard. If the shots had come from outside, then the snipers must have noticed something. They had the place pretty much surrounded. No one had come out of the building, so far as Webb knew. Yet if the shots had originated from outside, the shooter was already there when HRT had shown up, and that, once more, meant a probable leak of HRT's assault. None of it was good news. WFO was combing through the compound, looking for additional clues further linking the freeze to the hit on Charlie team. Webb hoped they could find enough to explain it all, though he doubted they could. How could you explain young kids and old men with that much hate in their hearts? Showered and changed, Webb and Romano were walking down the hallway of the admin building to leave when Bates appeared in front of them, motioned them to follow him into an empty office. "I guess I'm bad luck, Purse," said Webb, only half-jokingly. He really was wondering if he was suddenly jinxed somehow. Romano piped up. "No, really bad luck would have had us losing guys, not them. I'm never going to apologize for walking out of a place alive. Like flying a plane, man, any landing is a good landing." "Both of you shut up," said Bates, and they did. "The press will rip us on this, but we can handle it," the man said. "What I can't handle are two guys disobeying orders." "They were short-handed, Purse," said Webb. "And I can't believe you never told me. I was the one who put you onto that camera." Bates got right in his face. "I didn't tell you, Webb, precisely to prevent what did happen from happening." Webb didn't back down an inch. "Whether I was there or not, the result would have been the same. If you get shot at, you shoot back. And I wasn't going to let my guys go in weak. You can run me out of the bureau if you want, but I'd do the same damn thing again." Both men stared at each other until their features grew calmer. Bates sat down and shook his head. He looked up at the men and motioned them to sit too. "What the hell," said Bates. "It can't get any worse, so why should I worry?"
"If you were so concerned about something like this happening, why didn't you send a SWAT team instead?" asked Webb.
"It wasn't my call. Orders came from higher up."
"How high up?"
"That's not your concern."
"It is if my ass is going to be in the ringer over this."
Bates just stubbornly shook his head.
"If the shots came from outside, somebody knew we were hitting the place," said Romano.
"That's brilliant, Romano. Remind me to put you in for a promotion," snapped Bates.
"Leaks can come from anywhere," said Webb. "From the bottom up or the top down, right, Purse?"
"Stow it, Webb."
"Is there anything you can tell us, then?"
"Actually, the night wasn't a total waste." He turned and opened a file on the desk behind him. "Found some interesting stuff on the freeze. Silas Free was among the dead, and with him were several gents in their 60s and four men who weren't old enough to vote yet. I guess the freeze had really fallen out of favor after the school shooting. Recruiting problems."
"But no Ernest B. Free," said Webb. "I checked."
No Ernie." Bates pulled some papers out of the file. "But hidden in a space in the floor of one of the houses, we did find a quantity of bomb-making materials and three intelligence files on Judge Ledbetter, Scott Wingo, and Fred Watkins."
"Pretty clean trail," said Romano.
"And that's not all. We also found OxyContin, Percocet, and Percodan, with a street value of about $10,000.
Webb looked surprised. "The freeze working the black market for prescription drugs?"
"Membership down, probably funds running low. Oxy is a big-time moneymaker in rural areas. It makes sense, said Bates.
Damn, do you think that's the tie-in to what Cove was investigating? Freeze set up a bogus drug op center in D.C., Snooker Cove, and HRT gets called in and then wiped out.
Bates was already nodding. And maybe they're the ones putting the muscle on Westbrook and the other drug crews to get them to combine, added Bates.
Though Webb also nodded his head in agreement at this, something just didn't feel right.
We also found this, continued Bates, a roster of past and present members of the Free Society. He looked at Webb. Want to take a guess who was once a Free?
Webb shook his head. I'm too tired to think. Tell me.
Clyde Macy.
Webb forgot all about OxyContin. You're kidding me.
From 10 years ago until about 2 months after the shooting in Richmond, the Frees kept good records, maybe to use as blackmail on ex-members later when their cash flow ran low. KKK probably does something like that.
Macy a Free, and then he jumps to being muscle for a black guy in ghetto D.C. Epiphany, or the man just looking for work where he can get it?
Don't know. And we've now lost track of him. And of course, there's the other body.
What other body?
Antoine Peebles. Gunshot wound to the head. We found him last night.
You think Westbrook was behind it?
It makes sense, though nothing in this case has made sense so far.
Webb debated whether to tell Bates about Claire's run-in with someone impersonating Big F, but then finally decided against it. Webb didn't think the Giant had been behind Peebles' death, but he had no reason to help Big F, and he might just confuse things by telling Bates. Webb held out his hand for the file. Mind if I take a look?
Bates stared at him for a long moment. Sure, but if you see anything that hits you funny, I'd appreciate knowing about it before you walk out of this office.
While Romano stepped out of the room to speak to another hotel team member who passed by, Webb turned through the pages. There was a posed photo of a younger Clyde Macy in combat garb, holding a machine gun in one hand and a shotgun in the other, and with a scowl that would probably scare off bears. As he read through the file, Webb saw the speeding tickets Macy had gotten and that Bates had mentioned earlier. He glanced at the tickets and looked up. A guy like this and all he's got are speeding tickets?
Hey, such is life. He's one lucky or careful bastard or both, said Bates.
How about the rental truck that the machine guns came off?
Silas Free did rent it. We checked with the rental agency. They remembered him. But about a week after he rented it, he filed a stolen vehicle report.
Pretty convenient, said Webb.
No, it's SOP for people plotting some serious stuff. Rent the vehicle and then say it was stolen. And you hide it somewhere and fill it full of explosives, or in this case, machine guns.
The rental truck is direct evidence of the Freeze connection to what happened to Charlie Team, said Webb.
And after last night, we are going to need it, commented Bates ominously.
The next thing Webb turned to made his mouth go dry. He looked up at Bates and showed him the pages. What's this?
Oh, that's real cute. That's the Freeze newsletter. I guess they want to keep members informed on their various murder and mayhem. It's a fairly recent thing because I'd never heard of it before. They even have a website now, if you can believe it.
Webb didn't hear Bates's remark. He just stared at the name of the newsletter emblazoned across the top of the front page. Damn to Hell. That was the name of the Free Society's newsletter. And they were also the exact words Kevin Westbrook had spoken to him in the alley. Webb and Romano walked over to the vet. Webb was still deep in thought over what he had learned. It was all so murky, though, like the edges of a nightmare. You knew something formidable was lurking nearby, yet you couldn't get a comfortable handle on it. Webb stowed his gear in the vet and started to climb in the passenger side. Romano was looking at him with an expression that was probably as close to sympathy as the man ever got.
Hey, Webb, you know,
All the years we've been working together, I've never once let you drive this thing.
Webb looked confused.
What? How about you drive us back to the farm? Trust me, when you're feeling shitty, there's nothing like a ride in this machine to get you back.
Thanks, Polly, but I don't think so.
In response, Romano tossed the keys to Webb, who caught them. It's like a bottle of great wine, Webb. You have to sit back and just let the experience happen.
Romano climbed in the passenger side and looked at him.
You don't keep a beautiful woman waiting, Webb.
Don't tell me you gave this thing a name, too, like your guns.
Just get in, he winked at Webb and added, if you think you're man enough.
They drove out to the main road. Before they hit the highway, Romano said,
okay, rule number one, you get one scratch on her and your ass is mine.
You'd think after 8 years of jumping out of choppers with me in the middle of the night with explosives tied to our butts that you'd trust me to drive your stupid car.
Rule number two, you call her a stupid car again and I'll break your face. Her name is Destiny.
Destiny?
Destiny.
When they reached Interstate 95, Webb headed south and passed a state trooper writing a ticket. The hour was still early enough, and they were heading against traffic, so they were pretty much alone.
Okay, we got some breathing space now and a long straightaway, so punch it now or forever hold your gonads, said Romano.
Webb glanced at him and then hit the accelerator. The car roared to 100 so fast, Webb could feel himself being held against the seat by the force of the acceleration. They flew past the only other car on the road as if it had been parked.
Not bad, Polly, and I've only got it halfway to the floor. Let's see what it really can do.
Webb punched the gas again, and the car rocketed even faster. They were now coming up to a curve in the highway. From the corner of his eye, Webb watched Romano. The guy looked calmly ahead, as though he drove this fast every day. Hell, maybe he did. Webb cranked the car to 130, and then 140. The trees on either side were one green blur, and the curve was directly ahead. There was no way Webb could navigate it at this speed. Webb glanced at Romano again, and he saw a small bead of sweat appear on the man's forehead. That alone was worth about $10 million. They were 2 seconds from kissing a wall of pines.
Okay, okay, said Romano. Slow the damn thing down.
You mean slow Destiny down?
Just do it!
Webb hit the brakes, and they soared around the long curve at a mere 80 miles an hour.
Slow it down some more. I just changed the oil.
I'll bet Destiny loved you being inside her. Was it good for you, too? Webb cut it to 70, found an exit, and they pulled in front of a diner. Inside, they ordered coffee. As the waitress walked off, Webb leaned forward.
I hope you're prepared for the heat we're going to take about the freeze.
Romano shrugged but said nothing.
It's going to come, you know. Let it. Those pricks had it coming. Wasting Charlie.
They haven't been convicted yet, Polly.
The brass at the Bureau wouldn't have authorized the hit unless they were damn sure they knew those punks had done it.
He added in a less confident tone. At least, I sure as hell hope so. Webb leaned back.
What's bothering me about this whole scenario is the fact that we're expected to believe that the guys we just wiped out were sophisticated enough to put together an automated sniper nest using miniguns stolen from the army, and they did it so well that nobody saw it coming. And on top of that, they murdered a judge, prosecutor, and attorney using cutting-edge bomb materials, and came within a whisker of taking out Billy Canfield and you and me as well. And now they're supposed to be orchestrating a large-scale drug operation that's reached into the district? And this is supposed to be revenge for something that happened years ago? Hell, most of the guys we just shot were still in sixth grade back when Ernie and his buddies hit that school. Their stupid sentries were playing video games, and they had one subgun in the whole group. This shit does not compute, Paulie. Or am I missing something? No, it doesn't add up, he agreed. But you got direct evidence, Webb. Enough to go to court with and win. And who gives a shit about the Freeze? They're scum. That's right. Who cares about the Freeze? They make a perfect patsy. And everybody's figuring they busted Ernest Free out of a maximum security prison 2,000 miles from here, but he wasn't in that compound. And I'm thinking those losers would have as much chance of knocking over the White House as they would getting Ernie out of jail. Romano stared at Webb. Okay, you've got my attention. What are you thinking? I'm thinking why a real tough street drug dealer would bother to tell me about those tunnels. And I'm also wondering why a truck registered to Silas B. Free and later reported stolen is videotaped at the exact spot where we think the guns are going in once we know about the tunnels. You didn't hear Bates say that because you had stepped out of the room. Maybe Silas was telling the truth. Maybe the truck was stolen. But you're right. It's connect the dots time. Everything seems to fit. That may be nice and clean from a prosecutor's point of view, but I don't think even old Silas was that stupid, and I don't think my good buddy Francis Westbrook is that charitable. Webb looked out the dirty window of the diner as sunlight started to stream in. Wouldn't it be nice if things could clear up so pristinely in his head? He looked back at Romano. Were you born with a silver spoon in your mouth, Paulie? Yeah, right. One of 10 kids in tenement housing in Brooklyn? Hell, I had my own butler. Well, I wasn't born with one either. But my gut tells me we were just spoon-fed the sweetest damn concoction you ever saw, and we swallowed every drop. I think somebody wanted the Freeze wiped out, and we just did it for them. Chapter 46. When they got back to East Winds, Webb called Claire on her cell phone, but she didn't answer. He tried her at work and got no answer. Webb called the hotel where she was staying. No luck there either. He put the phone down, not liking any of that one bit. He mulled whether to go to the hotel or not. She might simply be in the shower. He decided to try later. The next thing he and Romano did was something neither of them could avoid. They grabbed a few hours of sleep. After that, they drove up to the main house and relieved the agents patrolling there. Gwen met them at the door, her face pale. "We've seen the news," she said. She led them inside to a sitting room off the main hallway. "Where's Billy?" asked Webb.
"Upstairs. He's just been lying in the bed. He hadn't seen that tape in years. I didn't even know it was on the damn shelf."
Webb could see that her face was damp with tears. "It was my fault, Gwen. I don't know what the hell I was thinking, playing that tape in your house."
"It didn't matter, Webb. It was bound to happen sometime."
"Is there anything we can do?"
"You've damn well done enough."
They all turned and looked at the doorway, where Billy stood in old jeans, bare feet, with his shirt tail hanging out. His hair was in disarray, and he basically looked like hell, observed Webb. Billy lit up a cigarette and cupped his hand for an ashtray as he came forward. Webb noted that Gwen made no move to stop him from smoking. He sat down across from the two men, his piercing eyes watching them from behind the drifts of smoke. Webb could smell the alcohol from where he stood and assumed Gwen could, too. She rose from her chair to go to her husband, but he motioned her back down.
"We saw the TV," said Billy.
"That's what Gwen said," replied Webb. Billy squinted at him as though he were having trouble seeing over the 1 foot that separated them.
"You killed them all?"
"Not all, most."
Webb kept his gaze on the man. Part of him thought Billy might toast the demise of the Freeze, and part of him thought the man might throw him and Romano out for leaving any of them alive.
"How'd it feel?"
"Billy," said Gwen, You have no right to ask that. We're talking about people being killed.
I know all about people being killed, honey, said Billy, as he shot her a smile that had nothing in it. He looked back at Webb, awaiting an answer. It felt like shit. It always feels like shit. Most of them were high school age or grandfathers. My son was 10. He said this without emotion, just stating it as a clear, indisputable fact.
I know that.
But I hear what you're saying. It ain't easy killing somebody unless you're way screwed up to begin with. It's only hard for the good guys. He pointed at Webb and then at Romano. For men like you.
Gwen swiftly went to her husband before he could stop her again. She put an arm around his shoulders.
Let's go back upstairs.
Billy ignored her. TV says old Ernest B. Free wasn't among the dead. That right?
Webb nodded and Billy smiled.
Some bitch's luck just keeps holding, doesn't it?
Looks that way, but if he was planning to come home to his little group, he'll have to find somewhere else to live.
Billy considered this.
Well, that's something.
He looked at Gwen.
Where's Straight?
Gwen seemed very relieved by the change in subject.
On his way back from the sale. He'll be here tonight. He called from the road. It went really well. Every yearling sold, and we got the price we wanted on every one.
Well, damn, that's something to celebrate.
He eyed Webb and Romano.
You fellas want to celebrate? I tell you what, we'll wait until old Nemo gets back tonight, and then we'll have us a little party right here. What do you say?
I doubt that they feel much like celebrating, Billy, said Gwen.
Well, I sure as hell do. We got yearlings sold, Freeze dead, and we got to give Webb and Paul here a going-away party. 'Cause with those boys dead, we don't need protection anymore, do we? Y'all can pack up and get out right now, he said in a loud voice.
Billy, please, said Gwen.
Webb was about to say that the jury was still out on Gwen and Billy being safe, but he stopped himself.
I tell you what, Billy, you let us stay on a couple more days and we'll come to your party tonight.
Gwen looked at him in astonishment, while Billy merely nodded and grinned, sucking down the rest of his cigarette with a long pull. He put it out in his leathery palm without even wincing. Webb noted the man's hands for the first time. They were large, muscular, and stained with what looked to be acid or something like it. Then he recalled the taxidermy workshop, killing and stuffing.
See you tonight, gents, said Billy.
Gwen led them out and told Webb in a low voice that he didn't have to do this.
I'll see you tonight, Gwen, was all he said in response, and she closed the door slowly after them.
What the hell was all that about? Said Romano. I mean, talk about your freaky shit.
Before Webb could answer, his phone rang. He whipped it out, hoping it was Claire, but it was Bates.
I guess it's time to pull the pole on the East Wind's tent, Bates said.
You can call your guys off, but the Canfields have asked Romano and me to stay.
Are you kidding me?
No, and I think it's a good idea, actually. The Frees who were at that compound are gone, but who's to say they don't have more members out there? And Ernie's still at large.
That's true. Okay, look, you hang there, but let me know if anything goes down, and I mean the second it happens, not Webb London time.
You got it. Anything from Cove?
Nothing. It's like he's disappeared from the face of the earth.
Webb thought about Claire.
Yeah, I got one of those too.
About the time that Webb was wiping out the Free Society in Southern Virginia, Claire Daniels sat blindfolded with a gag stuffed painfully in her mouth. She could hear men in the background discussing, or rather arguing, presumably about her. She recognized Ed O'Bannon's voice, and she bristled each time she heard it.
The bastard had kept the gun on her all the way down to the parking garage and then duct-taped her arms and legs and thrown her in his trunk. She had no idea where she was. As she blinked back tears, she still couldn't believe she had worked next to the man all this time and never suspected what was going on. The voices stopped, and she felt people moving toward her. All she could think was that another pistol was going to be placed against her head, and this time the person would surely fire and kill her. Claire was suddenly pulled up so roughly she thought they had popped her arm out of place. She felt herself being lifted up and put over a shoulder. Whoever was carrying her was strong. The man wasn't even breathing hard, and where her stomach was pressing against him, he felt hard as iron. A few minutes went by, and she was laid down, and then she felt the plink of metal against metal. Another car trunk. Blindfolded and shuttled from place to place, Claire had lost her sense of balance and also felt nauseous. The car started, and they were soon on the move. She tried listening for sounds that would provide some clue as to where they were, but she soon gave up. There were just too many confusing noises, and they were all muffled. She judged they had been driving for about an hour, when the movement of the car seemed to indicate that they had gone from straight, level roads to winding, rolling ones. Had they gone into the country? Were they driving her to some isolated, wooded area to kill her and leave her body for the animals, insects, and elements to slowly destroy? In her work with law enforcement, Claire had seen the remains of a woman who had been raped and murdered and left in the forest for 2 weeks. Other than bone, there was virtually nothing left of her. She had become sick at the sight of her. Was that how she would be found? The car slowed, and then she felt a sharp turn, and then it decreased its speed again. Now they were going over rough dirt roads, and she was pitched around in the trunk, hitting her head twice, once hard enough to bring tears. The car stopped again, and then she heard the engine cut off and the doors open. She braced herself. She heard footsteps moving to the rear. She tensed even more, the feeling of despair and helplessness far worse than she had ever endured before. What did it feel like to die? A bullet to the head, would there be any sensation of pain? Webb had been shot twice. He knew what it was like to think he was dying. He had survived, though, because he was a survivor. He had it much tougher in life than she had. She counseled folks over their troubles, and except for a divorce that was fairly amicable, Claire had had no significant disruptions in her own life. For the first time ever, she wondered what gave her the right, other than her fancy degrees, to tell people how to get through their issues. Yes, Webb had survived much. Claire didn't think she was that strong. She took a deep breath as the trunk was opened and strong hands closed around her and lifted her up. It wasn't O'Bannon. Claire knew he was a man of very little physical strength. From all around, she heard the sounds of the forest and animals that lived there, predators that might soon be visiting her remains. She initially fought back the tears and then just decided to let them go. These people wouldn't care. She felt the man moving over uneven ground, stumbling a few times, but then righting himself. His feet went from dirt to something else, wood, brick, or perhaps stone, she wasn't sure. But she had heard the change in sounds, and then a door was unlocked and opened. This surprised her because she had assumed they were in the middle of nowhere. Perhaps it was a cabin, but then she heard noises of machinery going and what she thought was the flow of water. Were they near a stream or river? Was there a dam nearby or a water treatment plant? Was that where her body was going to end up? Then she had a sense of either going up or down. She wasn't sure about that either, for with her ruined sense of balance, she had also lost her sense of direction. In fact, she thought she might be sick, and her stomach pushing into the man's hard, bony shoulder didn't help much. And there was also a strong chemical odor that seemed familiar, but that she couldn't quite identify, so out of whack were all her senses. For an instant, she thought that vomiting on him would give her some small sense of pleasure, of triumph, but it also might prompt him to accelerate the timing of her death. Another door opened, and they passed through, presumably into another room. He squatted and laid her down on something soft, perhaps a bed. Her skirt had risen up embarrassingly high while she'd been riding on the man's shoulders, and with her hands bound, she had no way to pull it down. She tensed when she felt his hands go up her legs to a point where she thought he was going to pull down her underpants and add rape to his list of felonies. However, all he did was tug her skirt down to its normal position. The next thing he did was pull her bound hands over her head, and the clink of metal made her think that he had handcuffed her hands to something, perhaps the bed or a ring bolted to the wall. As soon as he moved away, she tried to pull her hands down but couldn't budge them. Whatever she was handcuffed to, she wouldn't be able to escape it. "You'll get some food and water later. For now, just try to relax." She didn't recognize the voice. The man didn't laugh at his insane words, but Claire could easily sense the mirth behind them. The door closed and she was once again alone. Alone, that is, until she sensed movement from across the room.
"You okay, lady?" asked Kevin Westbrook.